Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of KleptoCast, the podcast series from the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. My name is Casey Michelle, and my guest today is Maciej Kisielowski, an associate professor at Central European University, where he focuses much of his research on constitutions, law, and public policy. Maciej has also written a recent piece in mid-July for Politico Europe on Poland's recent authoritarian slide, in which he described recent proposed legislation aimed at ending Poland's independent judiciary as a, quote, point of no return. So, Maciej, it's great to have you with us today, but I wanted to first ask about these recent pieces of legislation we've seen in Warsaw, especially aimed at ending Poland's independent judiciary, or at least attempting to end some of the independence. Can you give us a broad overview of what we've seen out of Poland since the Law and Justice Party came to power in 2015? Who are some of the primary players involved, and what are some of the things they're attempting to do?
Hi, Casey. Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me. Yes, so this the 2015 presidential and then parliamentary election, which happened by coincidence the same year, were really a 180 degree turn in Poland's politics. Poland for 8 years before was run by a center-right coalition of sort of mainstream Christian Democrat parties, kind of like Angela Merkel's CDU in Germany. And in 2015, this coalition lost, narrowly, but lost to a much more radical right-wing party that is, you know, very skeptical about liberal democracy as a concept, and skeptical about Europe. It has a certain paradox in its platform, because normally those illiberal parties in this part of the world are also pro-Russian. For example, Fidesz in Hungary, run by Prime Minister Viktor Orban, is quite openly pro-Russian. Polish Law and Justice Party, which is known increasingly even in the West by its Polish abbreviation PiS, is actually a little confused in this regard. It is anti-European, but also anti-Russian. It attempts to find some sort of third way for Poland, which increasingly doesn't look like a third way at all, but it looks like a scary old-style authoritarianism that we see in Turkey, Venezuela, Russia, and other places, Central Asia, of course. So while people sometimes tend to view this as a puzzling phenomenon, the fact that the country which has been labeled a champion of economic and democratic reforms is currently overtaken by such a movement. In fact, the platform of peace is a very straightforward authoritarian right wing concept, which we see in many other countries. Right. Yes, the only difference between many of those other countries and Poland is that peace doesn't have the support that, for example, Putin has in Russia, when the last Gallup poll indicates 83%, overwhelming support of the Russian strongman. Yes, peace won with the weakest margin, the weakest electoral victory of just 37.5%. This was the weakest electoral victory in 20 years, with an exception of an earlier peace victory in mid-2000s, when they had an even more flimsy coalition. But basically, all liberal and centrist government since 1997 had a much stronger mandate and much less appetite for constitutional revolution.
So peace comes to power in late 2015 with a notably smaller margin of victory than other illiberal or authoritarian parties in places like Russia or in Hungary. Nonetheless, they come to power. Led by Jaroslaw Kaczynski, who, however, is not the prime minister. He's not the president. Can you tell us just a bit about Mr. Kaczynski for listeners who are not familiar with him?
Yes. So Kaczynski is a former anti-communist dissident who was a noted figure in Solidarity in the anti-communist opposition in the 80s. He was a close aide of the first democratically elected Polish president, Lech Walesa. Mm-hmm. But they split soon after Walesa got into office. They had the famous split. And since then, Kaczynski has been running quite consistently for 25 years on anti-establishment, illiberal platform that questioned the basic parameters of the Polish democratic transition, which obviously has, you know, a lot of aspects and consequences that can be questioned. Yes, right. Pursued a very aggressive neoliberal economic model, the famous shock therapy that left millions of people, you know, in dire circumstances. Yeah. We also had a negotiated transition model, which for some people who value kind of moral clarity over pragmatism was unacceptable, that the former communist oppressors basically got away with what they were doing for 4.5 decades. And those two aspects of the Polish transition, which, you know, outside objective commentators would almost universally admit that those with all their side effects, those two aspects of the Polish path to democracy, the negotiated model without bloodshed, and the extremely quick economic adjustments, were in large part responsible for Poland's, you know, golden quarter century, where Poland closed in one generation, we closed half of the gap in terms of GDP per capita that separated us from Western Europe.
Yeah.
But it also created a significant number of losers of this transition, of people who feel deeply wrong. So we shouldn't, even though Kaczynski's party indeed got a very weak victory in 2015, It is absolutely true that there is some real core support, let's call it a third of society.
Yeah.
You know, you have a third of society that genuinely feels that they were left behind over the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. And judges and judicial apparatus is, you know, is a particularly vivid representation of the post-1989 elites, both on an economic and on the political side. Yes, right. Because on the economic side, judges are by far the best compensated public sector officials in Poland. And politically, obviously, you know, the fact that this is a profession requiring high skills means that, especially in early years after the transition, there was a significant number of people who, if they were not actively involved in communist regime, they were at least, you know, opportunistically coexisting with that regime. Now, of course, the problem is that it took Kaczynski 25 years to get the kind of power he has today. He was trying every election since the early 90s and was, with this exception of this very weak, even weaker victory that really didn't give him sufficient power, and it ended up very quickly after less than 2 years, in 2006. This is the first time he has a real stable majority, and he fought so the presidency. And that obviously makes this whole call to, you know, rid the judicial apparatus from communists a little grotesque.
Right.
Because now the average age of a judge is like less than 40 or about 40.
Yeah.
So obviously those people were not communists in their kindergarten. Yes.
No, probably not. So there is, I think it's fair to say, an increasing international awareness of both Kaczynski's and PiS's relationship with the Polish judiciary, especially over the past few weeks, due in no small part to your work, Message. But the past year and a half has also seen, it's not as if this is something that we've seen only in the past 2 weeks, only in the past month. This has been a trend we've seen over the past year and a half since PiS came to power. Can you give us just a quick overview, without getting into too many of the details, of the types of legislation that PiS has pushed that's both succeeded as well as we saw just today, at least temporarily halted, that PiS has pushed against the country's judiciary? Where have they succeeded? Where have they fallen short? And where do you think things are heading in the near future?
Yeah, so Poland, unlike the U.S. and like many other countries in the continental legal system, has a separate court that deals with constitutionality of laws, the Constitutional Tribunal, it's called. It's separate from the Supreme Court, which is hearing criminal and civil cases, which is the subject of the current controversy. But almost immediately after PiS got the parliamentary majority in 2015, PiS, with the help of President Andrzej Duda, who is a former PiS member of the European Parliament, so generally an ally of Kaczyński, they organized a grotesquely illegal but still quite effective attempt to take over the Constitutional Court.
Yeah.
And they succeeded, despite the protests of the Venice Commission, which is the Council of Europe, a constitutional watchdog, and the European Union and the Obama administration. Yeah. They basically took over the Constitutional Court and this was quite crude. I mean, they need 8 to have a majority. Yeah. 3 out of those 8 they took by basically electing their nominees on the slots already occupied.
Yeah.
and basically ignoring the results of the previous parliaments. Vote on three justices who simply didn't get the commission from from President Duda, and then less reported but perhaps even more egregious was the way they took over the chief judge of the Constitutional Court. Basically, it involved a change of procedure in which a small minority of judges were able to nominate a candidate for the for the chief judge, which the president then appointed.
Okay.
So in short, they completely took over the body that was responsible for checking whether the laws that the parliament, in this case peace-controlled parliament, enacts, whether those laws are consistent, whether these laws are constitutional.
Right.
Yes, which of course I was already writing at that time that this is a very serious long-term problem.
Right.
because once you don't have a court that can declare a law unconstitutional, that opens the door to serious abuses of power. Mm-hmm. And we saw it with this new legislation. If peace did not, or resisted the temptation of taking over the constitutional court, we would not have the discussion about the laws on the judiciary, because those laws were obviously unconstitutional. Right. And thereby, you know, even if peace passed them, any normally functioning constitutional court would immediately reject them.
Yeah, so taking over the constitutional court was the necessary first step in peace's plans to dismantle Poland's independent judiciary.
Well, yeah, well, in peace's plan to dismantle Poland's democracy. Uh-huh, yes, uh-huh. because it's the judiciary is not the ultimate objective. The right. ultimate objective, in my assessment, the ultimate objective is to harass the opposition, to basically compensate for flimsy support that peace has in the society. Mm-hmm. Yes, so this is basically an attempt to seriously limit, if not at all eliminate, the competitiveness of Polish election, mm-hmm. So that with a third of society on your side, you can stay in power. Mm-hmm. That's the basic setup. The courts are just a tool towards this end.
And so what aim has peace taken against the country's Supreme Court? Some of the recent legislation, I think, which has gained a lot of international notoriety, has been that which is focused on the country's, not just the constitutional tribunal, constitutional court that we saw a few months ago, but more recently what we've seen with the Supreme Court and the broader Ministry of Justice. Can you take us through some of that, the legislation that was recently proposed and that up until today looked like it may pass?
Yeah, so basically, if you are planning, you know, perfect bank robbery, the first thing you do is you disable the security camera. Mm-hmm. So the Constitutional Court was disabling the security camera. Okay. Yes, and now without the security camera, they started to rob the bank. Yes, yeah. And their idea was in this recent law, to dismiss 83 senior-most judges in Poland in one go, mm-hmm. with no reason, no review, no appeal. They called it a retirement, but it wasn't dependent on the judge's age. So basically, eviscerate the entire top judicial brass of the country.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the justice minister is appointed by
the prime minister.
Okay.
So this is peace. It's yeah. it's Poland's attorney general. So yeah. it's basically a peace politician. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now the rest of the new makeup after, you know, getting rid of 83 judges, would be filled by the what's called the National Council of Judiciary, which is a constitutional body. It existed.
Right.
But simultaneously with the law sacking 83 judges, peace passed another law which basically provided for a nearly complete control of the National Council of Judiciary by the parliamentary majority, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is peace. Yes?
Yeah.
So in other words, they sack 83 judges in one go, and then either their Minister of Justice or the majority through the politicized Council of Judiciary can fill in all 83 slots.
Right.
On Polish on Poland's senior appellate panels. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, obviously, these pieces of legislation, proposed legislation, they don't exist in a vacuum. And as I'm sure many listeners are aware, there have been massive protests taking place in Poland, especially in Warsaw, over the past few days, over the past week. And just today, on Monday, the 24th of July, President Duda seems as if he has noticed the size of these protests and has announced that he will postpone and veto these proposed pieces of legislation taking aim at the Supreme Court. And as you just described, those involving the Ministry of Justice. How surprised are you that President Duda has taken this move to veto these proposed pieces of legislation? Obviously, not everything as it pertains to local courts. He's letting certain legislation continue. But the higher level, the most notorious pieces of legislation he has taken a stance against, it seems as if there may be a rift opening between Duda and Kaczynski. What's your take on it?
This is highly encouraging. This mm-hmm. is great news, but it's also indeed very surprising.
Yeah.
President Duda was 3 years ago was barely known figure. He was a relatively low level peace politician. He was handpicked by Jarosław Kaczynski, mm-hmm. the real leader of the party, who, as you rightly mentioned, doesn't hold any formal office, but he holds practically all the power until today. So it seemed that he holds all the power in the country. He was handpicked by Jarosław Kaczynski to basically be an ultra reliable president mm-hmm. who doesn't have anywhere close to American president's power, but it still has a much stronger mandate. He is popularly elected in a popular vote, so mm-hmm. he's much stronger figure in Polish constitutional system than in most parliamentary systems like Germany, when you have basically a representational ceremonial functions. Right. Yes. In Poland's case, the president has a notable power of veto, which is again not as strong as in the US. It can be overturned by 60%, not by two-thirds mm-hmm. Of parliament. But given that peace, as I mentioned, has a razor thin majority, they won't be able to overturn president's veto. Mm-hmm. So this is only the second time he vetoed any laws enacted by peace mm-hmm. since 2015. The previous one was an important, and it was an early sign that many people ignored, right. But it was, I believe, 2 weeks ago, but it was a much lower profile law.
Okay.
So it's clear that the president is basically no longer willing to be just a puppet of Jarosław Kaczynski,
right.
and this is a truly remarkable moment. And you know, protests are important part of it, but
sure.
But I would say there is a more interesting question, especially for people who are interested in what we are talking about in a comparative context, which mm-hmm. is. An interesting question that emerges from Polish cases: what is the minimal level of popular support that you need to have to establish a kind of this soft authoritarian illiberal democracy?
Right.
Because clearly the reason, the ultimate reason why president is vetoing those laws is that there is enough people sort of at the center of political spectrum, mm-hmm. that he is counting that basically without them he's not going to win the second term.
Right.
Yes, he will be up for re-election in 2020, and of course with 37.5% of votes in proportional system, if you are lucky, you can get a thin parliamentary majority, but you can't get the presidency with 37%. You need to have 51% to get the presidency. Yes. So the question is, because we see it, we see for example Turkey. Yes, when Erdogan's party always gets, let's say, mid 40s in terms of support. So significant, like maybe even 10 percentage points more than peace, yes?
Yeah.
Even there, you know, they are incredibly heavy-handed because they don't feel safe, yes? They are jailing thousands of people because they see the opposition as strong. In Poland, subtract 10 percentage points from Erdogan's support and you have Poland,
right?
Yes? Is it possible for our comparatively minded listeners? We will see. We are a live, you know, experiment, natural experiment, in whether you can establish an authoritarian state with less than 40% of support.
Sure. And again, obviously, one of the primary factors or one of the primary differentiating factors between what we've seen take place in Turkey and what we've seen over the past year and a half in Poland is the role and ties with the European Union, obviously, which Turkey is not a member of. And I wanted to ask, just kind of as a final question, what role you can see or envision for Brussels. We mentioned the Venice Commission earlier. Obviously, there have been a handful of recommendations that have come over the past year and a half. We've even seen discussions of things like triggering Article 7 if some of this legislation is passed. Professor, what role has Europe played, should Europe play, or should they sit back and let this remain a purely domestic affair moving forward, especially given the kind of move we've seen from President Duda today?
So, logically, you would think this should be the biggest difference between Turkey and Poland, that we are members of the EU.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, however, over the last 1.5 years, it doesn't seem to be that much of a difference because Europe has done preciously nothing. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it issues strongly worded statements, but European Union's legal system, outlined in the treaties of Lisbon, basically that did not prepare the Union institutionally to deal with having authoritarian member states.
Yeah.
You have Article 7, which provides for a possibility of sanctions if certain democratic values and rule of law is not respected.
Yeah.
But Article 7 was clearly drafted with a view that any slip to undemocratic politics would be an exceptional occurrence, kind of like the election of Jörg Haider in Austria in early 2000s, yes?
Yeah.
And the best sign of this, the best proof of this is that Article 7 requires unanimity with just the exception of the country that is the subject of the vote.
Right.
It requires unanimity of all other member states to declare that there is a serious threat to democratic values and the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, it means that if you have just one more than one, if you have at least two authoritarian countries within the EU, then one strongman can go to the other strongman's aid and basically veto Article 7 procedure. Which is what Viktor Orban of Hungary very openly announced he will absolutely do if it's necessary, if it comes to that. And also, there is also a question whether European Union, whether it's really such a priority for the European Union.
Yeah.
Yes, after all, these are you know, relatively peripheral countries. Okay, Poland is a little more significant because it's big, yes?
Yeah.
But with Brexit, with refugees, the question is whether an average German, French, Italian voter would be so much worse off if Poland or Hungary become authoritarian states.
Yeah.
Yes? So if for those of us who believe in kind of liberal theory of international relations, in which countries' position at the international arena are reflection of a domestic interplay of interests, I don't see that many interests, as long as foreign investment is protected, but authoritarians, have a mixed, let's say they have a mixed record, yes, Venezuela, Russia.
Sure.
But business is also very short-term thinking, yes?
Yeah.
I mean, in a short term, it even may be better, yes? I mean, we have huge factories in both Hungary and in Poland, and both governments are saying, you know, if you just do business, you don't interfere with our politics, we welcome you with open arms, yes?
Yeah.
So as long as that happens, I am not sure there are, apart from moral imperatives, which may not be sufficient, there are such obvious pressing domestic reasons for Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron,
sure,
or others to, you know, to go this extra length, create all those precedents, and like aggressively go after Poland or Hungary. So basically, even though for the European Union it may not be the best outcome, realistically I wouldn't expect Europe to do anything about it.
Right.
And that means that, you know, Poles are basically alone in it. Unless we solve it ourselves, it is likely that nobody will help us.